From Islamic Finance News, the world's leading Islamic finance news provider, this is IFN Podcast.
My name is Sojatia. I'll be the moderator for the session. I represent Temenos. We are one of the largest banking system and technology provider, 3,000 plus customers in 150 countries, some of the largest Islamic banks and Islamic financial institutes, both in terms of the asset size or in terms of the customers that they're supporting are using our technology. Multiple times we have been rated as the number one Islamic core banking provider. I have the pleasure of hosting a panel with me today, and I would quickly request to my left, Pak Dima, to introduce himself.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Thank you for inviting me to this event. My name is Dima. I'm the group CEO of Hijra, previously known as Alami. We are an Islamic peer-to-peer lending company turned Islamic digital bank based in Jakarta, disbursing more than $350 million of financing to SMEs across Indonesia, and now coming up with digital consumer banks in Indonesia, launched late last year, and managed to garner over 250,000 users and accounts, and continue to develop the Islamic digital economy ecosystem powered by Hijra. That's a quick introduction by myself.
Thank you, Pak Dima. It's exciting to also hear about the work that you're doing in Indonesia in promoting Islamic finance, how you have evolved from being a P2P player to be full-service bank. And now you also did mention about how you are supporting the startup ecosystem while we are having a catch-up. So maybe we will touch upon more of that, how you're encouraging the startups and fintechs to come up. Encik Hafiz, if I may request you to quickly introduce yourself.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. Assalamu alaikum and very good morning. My name is Hafiz. I'm actually from Halal Development Corporation, an agency under Ministry Investment, Trade and Industry. I'm actually the head of Halal Integrated Platform. So our role is practically to facilitate the growth of Halal industry. So looking forward to discuss about this topic today.
Thank you, Encik Hafiz. One of the also interesting aspects about the halal economy is that you're supporting a lot of micro entrepreneurs, enabling them to have a platform through which they can run their businesses. It's about giving them the accessibility to the digital marketplace that is available out there. I would sincerely appreciate your work, and we are hoping that through the conversation, we would be able to identify key use cases in Islamic finance which can be supportive to the overall ecosystem that you are running with. With this, I would request Encik Jamaluddin to introduce himself.
Good morning and assalamu alaikum. My name is Jamaluddin Bujang from Gobi Partners, based here in KL. Gobi is a venture capital company. We've been around since 2021, so we are 21 years old now. The startup of in China came to Malaysia in 2015. So we've been around here for 7 years already. In terms of asset animation, it was 1.2 billion. That's over that 21 years. Yeah, it's not that we have 1.2 billion now. We have a few funds active now. We have about four funds active now. We have a few more coming up soon, inshallah. Our funds, we call ourselves a multi-stack fund manager. From early stage fund, and we have a growth fund, and we have a late stage fund as well. Most of our funds are here concentrated here in Malaysia. We also, our growth fund that we have just launched recently, about 2 months ago, covers Southeast Asia. That is for the growth companies. When I say growth, it's actually from, say, Series B onwards. So we also have our own initiative called Taqwa Tech Investments. That is to focus on well, we can talk more about this later, to focus on Islamic products or regional, geographical, and also founders in that matter. Yeah. So we have made a few investments in that space. So here we are.
Thank you very much. One of the critical aspects for any entrepreneur or any startup to survive or even to grow and sustain is funding. So the work that Gobi Partner is doing in supporting through the funding of various entrepreneurs and startups all across the funding value chain is sincerely appreciable. And we would want to talk more about through the discussion how you see the startups collaborating more with traditional banks and fintechs and reutilizing on the availability of funding, on the availability of governance and the framework, and you know, marrying it with the growth potential that startups would have. So we'll get more on it. With this, may I request Mona Rafiza to introduce herself.
Thank you, Sojaya. Assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. Good morning, everyone. So I'm Rafiza. I'm with CAF Investment Bank. So we're one of the five that was awarded by Central Bank last year for the digital bank license, subject to regulatory readiness review by the Central Bank. So we, I suppose, you know, the reason why I'm on panel up here is to discuss about how, you know, where we're going towards, you know, what do we see in the ecosystem working with all the various partners, as, you know, as what the earlier panel members alluded, is that, you know, we need to work together to build an ecosystem rather than working in silos. So I look forward to have this conversation and perhaps, you know, answer some of the questions, you know, from the audience out there, you know, later. Thanks.
Thank you, Poon Rafiza. So it's always an exciting journey to be to starting a bank, and that's what you're doing right now. One of the first digital Islamic banks in Malaysia. So a very welcome and a very congratulations and best of wishes for you to go live. And then coming now, since we, in the previous discussions, we saw the growth potential of Islamic finance. However, the accessibility is still less. We were looking at penetration of 5 to 8% kind of compared to conventional. But having said that, it's a $3 plus trillion economy as of now. And the industry, if you see, Southeast Asia happens to be the second largest in Islamic finance, so which is a credible job. And we have crossed something which is a major milestone, which is a pandemic. We are beyond that. So we are looking at technology and the adoption hand in hand going forward with the acceleration of digital technology post-pandemic. Now, at this juncture, if I may ask you, and that's an open question for all of you, and maybe we can start with Poon Rafiza and then and follow it through, is what you consider as the single biggest challenge for Islamic fintechs and digital banks?
Thanks. Okay, so I've been on this position. So what I'm currently doing is we're working with Central Bank to operationalize and, you know, build the bank for us to go to launch, right? And I've been on this position for more than a year already. And what I'm seeing is that there's a huge acceleration of technology out there. Both positive and negative, a threat, you know, with regards to all the cybersecurity. And when we look at all the various technology out there on what we can adopt at a digital bank, one of my biggest challenges is the fact that I have to face regulatory requirement from the Central Bank, and rightfully so, because, you know, they need to do that, you know, because they want to protect the consumer. But what I find is that often a lot of the requirements when we submit our, say, for example, you know, a certain technology to be applied for the digital bank, often the regulatory environment is about 10 steps behind. So as a regulated entity, we find it very difficult to be able to catch up with the technology out there. So sometimes I know, you know, now I understand why consumers, sometimes we get frustrated. Why is it that the banks can't do this? You know, the technology is out there. It's less about the bank, but it's just that the regulatory environment may not necessarily be ready to adopt that technology. So that's number one. So I find that, you know, as a regulated entity, that's my biggest challenge. Number two is also in-house capability. We've been given 2 years by central bank to, you know, to launch. And there's no way we can actually have built in-house capability. So, which means that we have to rely a lot on partners out there. But there is a balance between relying totally on partners, because, you know, this is where we find it sometimes, you know, very difficult to have that ownership, you know, and especially with respect to, you know, security and everything. But at the same time, if we were to build an in-house capability, and we notice that that's the typical model of an incumbent bank, can the in-house capability really accelerate together with, you know, the technology acceleration out there? Because, you know, as one day, you know, inshallah, I'll be the CEO of the bank when we launch, my business is to serve customer. My business is to actually run a bank, you know. I don't think I have the capacity to actually build an in-house capability, you know, and then otherwise I'll be a technology, you know, CEO. So how do we balance that? So I think those are my biggest two dilemma, you know, based on my experience so far in building this bank. Thanks.
Just continue what we were talking about. Talking about hurdle, we mentioned about hurdle, right? For VC, there are two bankers here and two non-bankers. As far as VC concerned, I think you know, first off would be capital. I think a lot of people don't understand that. No, they don't see that VC gives money, right? Fund companies, but VC raise money themselves. So we have to go out and raise money from LPs. And unfortunately, in Indonesia, the number of institutions or, you know, that provide funding to VC, not to startup, and sometimes we even compete for deals as well. It's not as big compared to obviously the West or the Middle East, for example. So capital is one, because without capital, we're just no one. We cannot raise money, cannot invest companies, number one. But having said that, I think the industry is more open now. There's a lot of big institutions providing funding to VCs. If you notice last week, Coop announced, $500 million just to be allocated to VCs, actually half of it. I think other institutions are following that model as well, so which is good. And the government also has been very active in deploying money to give to VCs through Penjana, through MEFCAP and all that, which is good. But of course, we need more and more in that. The other thing is the number of startups, because we talk about Takwatek, for example. We can only invest if there's relevant companies in that space, right? So my wish is actually to see more and more companies, startups involved in the coming up, you know, Takwatek products or services that serve the Muslim community. And there are a few. We have done quite a few investments in that space, but we're looking for more actually. Yeah.
If I can add to that, talking from the point of view of the halal industry player, right? I think the two biggest challenge when we want to introduce fintech and also Islamic banking to the industry will be, number one, of course, the digital literacy. Because we noticed that there's a lot of people, yes, we assume that MCO has somehow transformed them to become, you know, digital savvy, but there's still a lot of companies out there, they are not, you know, digital savvy. I would say they understand digital, but they are not on board 100% on digital. They were forced to last time, but after MCO, some of them choose to go back to the traditional way. So that is why I think when we introduce new things, when we introduce digital solution, when it comes to adoption, it's quite difficult. That's number one. Number two is with regards to financial literacy. So we noticed that there's a lot of companies out there. They don't understand how can they leverage and utilize the traditional banking facilities. So imagine if you introduce a new fintech services, new solutions, It takes time for them to understand. I believe one of the example that I can share is we have MicroLeap here. We try to introduce peer-to-peer sharing our financing to our halal industry players. It has been 2 years, but the take-up rate is not that good as what we thought. So this is the two biggest challenges that we are facing right now. So I can share one of our experience because we are actually operating our halal integrated platform. So this is where we require them to register. So for them to even register, we don't even request a lot. It's just email and password. And there is this one instance when I went to Sarawak, they came to us and said, I don't have laptop, I don't have mobile phone. So how do I get on board into this? So these are the challenges that we are facing on the ground with the players, which is practically the one who's going to enjoy these services, right?
Yeah, I think although like we're running a bank, but our DNA is very much startup. We started back in 2019. So from that angle, the biggest hurdle is capital, right? I second Jamaluddin over there. Capital is what hold us back, because our business thesis is if we manage to come up with a competitive rate and service level peer-to-peer with the conventionals, I think in a market like Indonesia, where there's a lot of demand on halal lifestyle, I think people will come to us, right? But I guess to be able to get there, to be able to be at par with the conventional banks, like we need capital, we need to hire good talents, etc. So obviously, after COVID is the best time to raise, but then after that, it's winter, and it's hardly, I mean, we haven't really seen a lot of growth in capital being deployed in this part of the world, but with the geopolitical that happens, I'm sure like you guys follow Sequoia, GGV Capital, the split between China and the US, I think Southeast Asia will be the place that eventually, inshallah, can be very attractive when it comes to returns, but I think we need to wait until probably earliest next year, second half, to realize that. And I think the theme is working internally to kind of like be best at, then when capital came, that we can be well positioned for it. And second is also related to capital is the human resources, right? Manpower. But what's interesting here, it's often lagging, right? Like, so when the capital gets depleted and the whole industry is a little bit unsure, I think there's a lag time between talents moving back to corporates, moving to other places, and when the capital is there, then it still takes time for people to come back, right, to the industry. So I guess, but hopefully it's a little bit faster, because then I think the industry has more track record over the last 5 years. So the one that will stay would be the one that survive and being run properly. So I think just to wrap this up, I was in one of our investors' sharing session, AC Ventures, Supandu there. So someone asked him about what does he think about fintech, right? So he said like fintech, the inclusion, et cetera, in Southeast Asia, especially Indonesia, is very much needed. It will be continued to be required going forward. But I guess over the last 5 years, there's so many fraudster, pranksters, it's overvalued, etc. So the sector has been haram, according to his word, and now it's becoming like halal in a way that fintech is one of the verticals that get hit so much with this turbulent times. And a lot of the fintech that hasn't been run properly has been, you know, plug in all of the losses with equity. And now when they couldn't raise and people can see which company is actually being run properly and what's not. So I think over the next 1 to 2 years, like we would really see the consolidation of fintech, be it is Islamic or non-Islamic. And hopefully by that time, a lot more non-Islamic will fall. And given the ratio, I think lesser Islamic will fall. And hopefully there will be a better level playing field between the conventional and Islamic going forward.
Thank you very much for sharing your thoughts. So essentially, capital is one of the critical roadblocks or challenges that we see. You did mention that there would be consolidation in the fintech space, and we will see some capital readjustment across the industry. But having said that, we also know that traditional banks, they do have both the human capital as well as the investment capital, the financial capital that they can leverage upon. And the fintechs, on the other hand, have the growth mentality, the agileness. They can create products much faster than a traditional bank would because of various legacies, be it technology or processes and whatnot. Now, how do you see, and this question goes on probably for you as well as Park Dima, as well as Encik Jamaluddin, is how do you see banks collaborating with fintechs wherein the capital can be repurposed into the growth that fintechs are able to bring in, and the products can be, and the value that the fintechs are creating can be repurposed in the bank's product chain or supply chain, if I may?
I think we've seen like some collaboration happen already between banks and fintech. I guess it comes like bank and peer-to-peer lending, bank and wealth management app, and all of these things. I think from banking perspective, especially on Islamic bankings in Indonesia, I think it takes time for them to really realize that there's a partnership model that can work, because they've seen like the conventional banks have already done so and been successful, especially on getting, I mean, deploying asset and getting liabilities. I think we've seen a seamless integration between, say, Bank Jago and Bibit, or like Ajaib or Credifo, Bank Permata, so all of these things. For Islamic, I think there's less fintech available and able to scale that high, because typically the banks, they would require like 100% cash collateral, that blah, 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 right? Which means like the fundraising process would probably go to the bank and being pledged 100% and get capital deployed. So that has been the modus operandi. Obviously, over time, they can reduce it bit by bit in terms of the LTV. But I guess the fintech needs to be like well capitalized first, so the bank can be more comfortable to fund it. I think that's one. And so the model should be the bank has the license, has the trust, has the better risk management than fintech. I think the bank could do bank as a service type of model, because then, like we've seen, like Bank Danamon's been doing that. They've been our anchor bank on, because our Hijra bank is a rural bank in terms of the license, so we need to have an anchor bank for now. So working with Permata, and we switched to Danamon, and I guess we can explore more collaboration. So for example, we're about to launch Islamic Mortgage, so they can be our funding partner as well. So as long as the collaboration is clear on who's going to be the front-facing, who's going to be on the back end, this and that. And what we've seen in Indonesia especially, the talents in the banking sector on the digital team has also been better over years. So we've seen a lot of young people coming from the big tech start to work in the bank. So their way of thinking and how they convince the senior management is also different. So we've been seeing more and more. Unfortunately, again, with the winters, a lot of initiatives being held back. Some banks got burned by some bad actors and they got traumatized, this and that. So I think it's a little bit low on the low side right now, but hopefully next year things get picked up again.
Great. So we do have some good news to look forward to, if I may, with this readjustment of capital, both in terms of human or investment capital. Jamaluddin?
Yeah, I just want to add, from our portfolio, this one company, it's an early wage access company. So they're working with the bank as well. So they get a capital, if need be, from a local bank, and we have seen a few companies in that space also trying to do exactly the same thing. The thing about startup, especially in fintech, it's not only with bank, they work with anyone, right? Our friend in P2P as well working the same thing. You mentioned, yeah, obvious, because they can move fast. They can, in fact, they complement banks. Banks are more ready to work with this kind of companies because their processes is different, and the amount of disbursement is different as well. And this is where they need to work together even more closely for with fintech companies.
Perfect. So we do see a lot of banks collaborating with fintechs, and not just banks, as you mentioned, there could be other established large conglomerates or companies which can also collaborate with fintech.
Yeah, Saucha, if I
sure.
add that, yeah. So as you know that for CAF, the digital bank, so we work with three other consortium partners who are tech and also fintech. So we've got Genexu, we've got Qasim, and we've also got Money Match. So this is where we believe the model is that, you know, rather than build things ourselves, leverage with our partners. So these are our consortium partners, but it's not going to stop us from working with all the small technology partners out there. And in fact, we've already started to talk and meet with some potential partners. So, you know, so it's we hope, we really hope that this model work. I have seen it not in financial sector, but in other industry where I came from. So this is one way where, you know, and for that fintech, the minute that they have a partnership with an established firm, it becomes a lot, it's a lot more attractive for them when they go to VCs. Obviously, VC will see, you know, very favorably if these fintechs have got some sort of a partnership or collaboration, arrangement with an established, because it provides market access to the small companies, which is a lot easier for them to scale rather than if they were to go out there on their own. Yeah.
If I can share, we work a lot with fintechs, Islamic fintechs. We noticed that most of the Islamic fintech, they are looking into the space where the banks don't really go, which is the unbanked and the underserved, right? So this is where with our strategy, what we do is that in order to help this group to become bankable and to be able to leverage on banks, they need to first look into fintech. Because normally fintech player, they have a lower risk threshold, and then they can serve a bigger, wider market. So this is, from our experience, we truly believe that banks and fintech need to work hand in hand, but they have their own areas that they need to cover. And of course, we need to be able to map the journey where from, the moment where you become unbanked and underserved, and later you can create your credit ratings and whatnot, then you can start leveraging on banks. So that's those are the journey that we do, and those are the things that we promote in our platform, even though there's no formal relationship yet, but we create that journey so that people can go through that journey, and at the end of the day, adopt fully 100% Islamic finance.
Perfect. So two very important facts that came out is essentially collaboration is required with the fintechs, and they can work in two spaces. One is banks collaborating with fintechs like CAF has done and provide banking as a service to the end consumer. And also what I gathered from Enchi Hafiz is that you also see the potential of fintechs going out and addressing the unbanked or the underbanked, which are not yet being served by the banks, the traditional banks or the regulated banks. It's probably because the cost of entry into the fintech ecosystem is much lower rather than having a bank account. So that's what you're hinting at. So these are very interesting facts that you shared. Now, with this, if I may just go a little slightly back and talk about what we're talking about, the industry players, we are going to come and talk about the consumers as well, how they are shaping up the industry eventually. But before that, since Puan Rafiza also mentioned the regulatory angle, I just wanted to touch upon how are you, I know you from the past, you had been with the regulators in the past, so you wore multiple hats. So from that point of view, how do you see the regulator collaborating with either the fintechs or the banks or various other industry bodies in updating, or rather having a framework which is more inclusive for the fintechs to operate, for instance?
Yeah, so Bank Negara, it's very challenging I must say I give the hats to central bank. They are trying very work. They're trying very hard. You know, like I'm sure some of you, you know, aware they have this regulatory Bank Negara regulatory sandbox, where they actually invite those fintechs out there to actually develop their technology, you know, within a a controlled environment. So one of our consulting partners, MoneyMatch, is one of the first that graduated from that regulatory sandbox. So that's number one. Number two is that they do engage with us, with especially with the digital banks. Ever since we, you know, we've been on board, we have at least you know, a monthly engagement with central bank, because they also, you know, want to understand, okay, what are these new technologies that we are introducing into the banking services that currently are not being used by the incumbent. So, you know, they are working very hard, but it's just that it's just very tough to keep up with the technology advancement out there. And they've been, so for us is that, and we're quite lucky because, you know, central bank, Bank Negara in Malaysia has actually been very, very proactive, and even then they're struggling. How about in other, you know, jurisdiction where we may not have a certain bank, you know, the equivalent that becomes more proactive? Then you have all these unregulated players, like what, you know, the first panel sessions out there. So you have, you know, lenders that pretend to be a bank and misleading the consumer. So they're basically digital loan sharks, you know. And the consumers, to be fair to them, you know, not everyone is aware of what's happening. And they think that, oh, you know, someone is providing them with money. You know, they give example, maybe 1%. And then they're like, oh, wow, you know, that's a good deal. But, you know, it's compounding. And then the next thing you know that you're paying three times more than what you borrow. So I think these are some of the issues which, you know, how do we address this? You know, how do we educate to the public, you know, what they should and what they shouldn't do? And I think this is where, you know, we at CAF Digital Bank, that's what we are hoping to do. One of the commitment that we have provided to the central bank prior to us providing funding to the micro SMEs, you know, we make sure that, you know, they have a minimum level of digital literacy before they can even, you know, use our banking services. And it's got to be done in a, you know, in an industry point of view. So as a bank, we need to be responsible as well to the consumer. So it's not just about making money, but, you know, we also need to make sure that our customers are not taking advantage of, yeah.
Yeah, I just want to add, she mentioned a very interesting thing about digital literacy. And we just had a discussion back there just before we came here. And then, you know, you were saying, well, I wish she kind of surprised me because he said that, maybe you can comment later, businesses, SMEs, for example, they don't want, you know, they don't understand how to use the technology and all that. And they always see that technology you know, it's very
expensive.
Risky. You know, you can lose money. You can get there's a lot of training. You know, information sharing and all that needs to be done, because I think the only way for us to move forward is if you ask me, I would support for 100% cashless economy. You know, you can track where the money is moving. From there, you can do so many things, right? You know exactly which which sectors performing and all that, all the data that you have. You know, if the adoption of technology is slow or being resisted upon, just like recently, I see that's a bad thing. I think it's a job of the regulator, or even every one of us, of course, to re-educate, you know, people to understand technology and trust technology, that technology works and works for them. It is safe. I think that's the biggest, that would be the biggest thing that, you know, as a country we should overcome.
Thank you for sharing your thoughts. So essentially, the way we gather is that the regulators are trying to do their best. They have the frameworks. However, there is with the consumers, there is a lack of digital literacy or even financial literacy, and that's why Poon Rafiza mentioned that it's the role of the banks to be able to educate the customer before you take them on board so that they are aware of all the TNCs that they're signing before they actually sign up and take up a loan, for instance, right? Or financing, for instance. So with that, now coming to the consumers, because they are the most critical aspect over here. So how do we see the consumer shaping the financial industry, especially with Islamic finance per se? And if I may ask with Pak Dima.
Yeah, so I think it's the key. I think when you split the market between B2C or B2B, I think the low-hanging fruit for Islamic finance is the B2C, right? Because I think individuals tend to have more the Muslim like moral compass rather than an SME, especially if it's jointly owned by several people. I think it's always trying to be more logical and rational in terms of the decision-making, but then for oneself, it's more, inshallah, value-driven. So I think that's also the reason why we got into the B2C space. And I think we're talking about literacy, but I think the Islamic finance, there are two types of literacy. One is the financial literacy itself, and second is the Islamic literacy. I think what we've seen in Indonesia, I think, and everywhere in the world, financial literacy is not easy. Like even like my mom, you know, if I talk to her about financials, she'll be like, you know, just give me in a layman terms, I don't understand, just do it for me, blah, 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 right? And my mom has graduated from UI in Indonesia, and even her is like that. So can you imagine like where a lot of people, especially those who are not as educated or not exposed to high finance, will have problem on the literacy part. So that's where the other side of things, the Islamic literacy, it really comes in handy in rural area in Indonesia. It's just where some of these leading ustads or ulamas are preaching about what's good and what's not in terms of lifestyle, not only on the financial space, but any other Islamic lifestyle. And people listen, and when ustad says, don't do this, and they will follow, and they will learn later, but then that actually been driving the adoption of Islamic finance in Indonesia. I mean, we're seeing the pre-merger of Bank Syariah Indonesia. BNI Syariah has one of the lowest cost of fund of Islamic banks in Indonesia, and it's been driven by the Wadiah savings account, the 0% savings account, and it's mostly driven because of the positioning of BNI Syariah as being quite conservative in its marketing due to the CEO back then. So I think we're seeing, if we can really push on the financial literacy as we are still striving to push that up, and we need to work together on the Islamic literacy, because these are the people that will be inelastic to pricing. These are the people that will be your early adopters and eventually becoming your power users. And then the financial literacy part, it's way more effective to educate them using gamification of the app itself. So for example, rather than coming to an SME business owner and teaching him what to do, this is how you split your asset liabilities, P&L and all, you can just come up with an app like what we have here. We have like business accounts, like just show like some of the boxes and charts and all. So when you receive the money, it automatically go to one box, and this one box for expenses, so you can split your financials, and eventually you can export it in terms of the Excel or PDF. So really gamify these things, make it easy for them, and kind of like quote unquote force them into the right direction. And I guess that's how we can be very effective in improving the financial literacy by them actually doing it. So that's my two cents on literacy.
Thank you, Pak Dima. So essentially what you're saying is you're reiterating what Poon Rafiza said, that it's the bank's responsibility to drive the literacy also with the users, and they can do it by gamifying the experience that they have with them.
Yeah, I think when we talk about whose responsibilities, I think as a startup, you're racing against your runway, right? So if you're not doing it, then your runway is gone, poof, like don't even have 1 year back then. So we need to think on how to drive these things. Of course, we're working with the regulators and others on this, but we need to take things into our own hand as much as possible and push this. Actually, also the single biggest lever on the digital economy, fintech adoption, including Islamic, is the OJK moving from rule-based to principle-based rulings. So that's actually clear up a lot of things and install critical thinking in how they make the decision. And it has been going on, and it's been like going great. And the Bank Indonesia, BI, is also doing that with the sandbox and whatnot. I think we're very happy, especially after the omnibus law for finance that will push all the financial system into digital, including the rural banks and all. So this is actually a regulation that favor innovation, and especially our cause, as we are the first rural bank that got into digital, and the Islamic, among Islamic and non-Islamic, we're the first one. So I guess it's a very exciting times for us and for the country and the industry. And hopefully after all of this winter, that comes spring, and we can start to fundraise again and push these things to the next level.
Great. So if I may take this question to Encik Hafiz, and slightly different. So essentially, not from a B2C point of view, but from a B2B point of view, since you are you're interacting with micro entrepreneurs and everybody, and specifically entrepreneurs who are there on the Halal platform. How are they shaping? Because they have different financing needs compared to a consumer, end consumer, right? So how do you see them shaping the industry, the financial services industry in Islamic finance, based on the needs that micro entrepreneurs, SMEs, and in the B2B sector?
Okay, thank you. From our point of view, I think there's a lot of opportunity out there. Definitely, you know, if they can understand what they can have access to, then they can actually, you know, grow further. Now, that is actually the thing that we are looking at, because of, we were entrusted by Bank Negara to become one of the platform to promote the Islamic banking. So far, one of the biggest challenges is actually to identify what is the niche of Islamic banking as compared to the conventional. What they see at the moment, as at least from the Malaysian point of view, is that you have conventional products and you have similar product, but it's Islamic. That's the only thing that they see at the moment. So what we are trying to do in order to promote more Islamic products, we are trying to give feedback to the banks and even the fintech player to incorporate social financing as part of the financing program. In fact, at the HDC ourselves, we actually develop a wakaf fund so that they can start utilizing the social financing mechanism that we have in Islamic finance, which is wakaf, zakat, arahnu, takaful, and even sadaqah. So these are the five things that we are looking at, and we hope that we can work together with Islamic Bank as well as the Islamic fintech player to start adopting the social financing to be part of the offering, so that we can have a better niche as compared to the conventional. So once we have this, then it's easier for us to start telling them, look, you know, why you need to go Islamic is because, you know, this is the advantage. So yes, there's a lot of potential. In fact, we are working closely with MIFC. They are like us, but they are looking into Islamic, Sharia compliance, and they are coming up with the program called From Halal to Toyib. So now we are supporting that. So when we talk about halal to toyib, it means that you're already producing halal products. Now let's go into Sharia compliance business. So inshallah, I think moving forward, we are paving our way towards that, and working together with other agencies to hopefully we can help to promote more adoption of Islamic banking.
So you brought in a very valid point, is in terms of while literacy is important, Islamic literacy, financial literacy is very important. But having said that, it is also important to understand what is the niche of Islamic finance compared to conventional finance. So, and now my question is to the panel. I'm not going to point at any individual, but if you can just share your thoughts, maybe we start with one, Rafiza. How niche is Islamic finance, and how do we establish that in the market?
Yeah, so it's a very tough question. I get that all the time. Like, what's the difference, you know, conventional apart from the just the word I? As much as I wouldn't call myself an Islamic banking expert, you know. I was at one point in time with Thomson Reuters. I was head of Islamic finance. And again, you know, one of my biggest challenges, and this is globally, you know, what's the difference between Sharia and conventional banking? From this is my personal view, okay? Because, you know, as I delve more into Islamic finance, and I find that, you know, if you really, really want to practice Islamic finance, you know, being in a conventional environment or especially regulatory environment is very, very tough. Because if you look at the concept of Islamic finance, it's all about participating, equity, you know, profit sharing, risk sharing. But the minute a bank tried to do that, you know, they're being charged, you know, capital charge, right? And that's not going to be positive to their, you know, capital requirements. So this has always been a tough, you know, for an Islamic bank to really, really adopt Islamic finance within what I would call it a conventional design. And that's more towards, you know, conventional banking. And hence why we will always find it tough to innovate. And one of the things that I was also asked when I first took this job, oh, how are you going to start introducing, you know, innovative Islamic products? Because I think that's what the market really want out there rather than a copycat of conventional and just making sure that there's no riba or there's no speculation and, you know, all that. So can we really, really practice Islamic, you know, Islamic finance in banking? It's not going to be very easy at the moment because, like, again, when you want to bring people and when you want to sort of convert, even the Muslims, convert them, you know, from practicing conventional banking to Islamic, you need to give them a comparison what they can understand. You can't just suddenly introduce one new product that's not in conventional and accept them to adopt it because they will always compare, oh, what's the difference, you know? So, and that's what the industry is facing, you know, at the beginning. You want to make sure that it's a product that people understand, but at the same time, you know, it adheres to Sharia principle. Once I think we have that acceptance, and I think this is where, and subject to, you know, again, change in regulatory environment, because as much as I would love to introduce new innovative products that's more related to, you know, profit sharing, equity sharing, and risk taking, but our regulatory environment is not allowing a bank to do that commercially viable. So until we can address that, I think, and then you will continue to see, you know, not very different Islamic products to conventional. That I'm just being very upfront up here. You know, this is my personal view. Please don't take it as, okay, this is Kaf's views. You know, this is just my own personal view from, you know, coming from a third party and being really, you know, unbiased, unjudgmental about, you know, where we are at the moment. Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, very interesting. Yeah, very, 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 very good point. I have this question as well. You know, how come the Islamic banking product services, at least here, I don't know about other countries. Here in Malaysia, I'm paying premium to the, you know, to my mortgage, for example. Because when I think about as an Islamic bank, again, I understand all businesses have their own cost of running things. You know, if you really follow, you know, Islamic banking, if you put money, you don't need to expect interest, right? They're already one element of lowering the cost of capital in the Islamic banking. Again, I have my own opinion. That's just my view. I think really in the long term, you know, if you really, you know, have some sort of structure or idea or support that really make Islamic banking works, I think this is something that you need to look at, because I think if at all, if any difference between conventional and Islamic banking, probably the most significant difference is fractional banking, right? Look at fintech companies. We get 100 ringgit, we can loan out 100 ringgit. That's it. If you lose, everyone lose. That is a true risk sharing. That's what investment is. That's what I mean. But obviously, bankers have their own opinion, but that's how I see it. But another, I think a question she brought up, you know, about regulatory. Maybe another reason is, you know, regulator being regulated, the consumer protection is always in their mind, right? I think that reason is maybe because they also come from the conventional banking from the very beginning in the first place. So I think to change, you know, the way of doing things, looking at things in terms of treating risk, you know, will take time. Will take time before that were to happen. Again, if I can answer you that, yeah.
Sure. So while I have you on the mic, my next question is for you. So essentially, niche is something Islamic finance is trying to create, and there are challenges. There are ways, as we discussed, and we can reach there. Technology plays an important factor, and you being privy to the growing startup economy, the ones which are not even funded probably. How do you see the role of artificial intelligence and machine learning coming up in various innovative use cases in the fintechs or the startups that you are looking at the moment? Enchi Jamaluddin.
I'm not really an expert, but it is useful, definitely. The thing about AI is it processes things faster than we normal human or even current technology allows, right? But I thought AI is kind of fad also recently, just like crypto and stuff like that. But anyway, the real players will be out there eventually. I think it will help tech companies to do things better, faster, cheaper, right? All three works in unison. Definitely will, you know, the impact will be cross boundaries. Again, as a proverb, you know, it brings challenge to startup companies, because now your product or your services is not gonna be just local, but it's actually, you know, it will be international, cross-border, and also the same thing applies to him as well. So again, I think it's good generally, but let's see. Still, I think will take some time before that will come to, you know, a full impact or to a full circle.
And so while we are on technology, one another important factor that comes up is collaboration between, say, Indonesia and Malaysia. How do you see that scaling up in Islamic finance, both collaboration in terms of banks, in the technology companies, startups, fintechs? How do you see that coming up?
Yeah, Indonesia is a very important market to Malaysian investors, companies, definitely, because we only have a population of 35 million? About 35 million people. Indonesia is 300. Definitely Indonesia. And we speak, you know, same language. It's only 1 hour, 2 hour flight. Languages, we understand. So we understand the market. We want to understand the market. We're always encouraging companies to go out into Indonesia to scale up. And there are a few under our own portfolio has gone there as well. But the results still mix. Indonesian market, despite the size, is not as easy as, you know, one would make it out to be. You still need to slog it off, really work very closely, really spend time. You cannot, like, you know, okay, 1 week I'm here, 1-2 weeks I'm going to be there and stuff like that. You really have to be there, understand the market, despite all that. But yes, we always encourage companies to really go into Indonesia and expand the market, because that's the closest and probably the most familiar for tech companies here, actually.
If I can add on top of that, From the halal point of view, I think we should, Malaysia should be working together with Indonesia and the rest of the Southeast Asia country. Why? It's because when we talk about halal industry, Southeast Asia has the biggest market share. So if you want to push or you want to expand the adoption of Islamic finance, Islamic banking, I think we should be working together because right now in the halal industry itself, we already working together because we need to be the rice bowl of halal, the world halal ingredients. And of course, the recent MOU between Malaysia and Indonesia, where we recognize Indonesia halal certificate, this is where Indonesia acknowledge Malaysia as the manufacturer, but Indonesia will become the ingredient provider. So imagine the opportunity there. I think banks that has footprints in multiple countries, for example, like UOB, RHB, and CIMB, they will have a bigger advantage. In fact, I think even fintech can also play a big role here in terms of, you know, be part of this opportunity. So I believe that we need to, whether we like it or not, we need to work together in order to serve this industry.
Absolutely valid point. With the halal market being biggest in Southeast Asia, it only makes sense to work it hand in hand with Islamic fintech to finance that entire value chain. So with this, we come to the end of the session. But before we leave, I just wanted a minute from everyone just to speak about what is that one message that you would want to give out to the industry. It could be a new fintech, it could be a bank, a traditional Islamic bank, or it could be the regulator or the analyst. So maybe we start with Paktima. One message.
Sure. And I think it's related to the niche. I think Islamic finance shouldn't be a niche. I think it should be generic where a lot of people can use it. I mean, we've seen a lot of kosher banks nowadays coming up from Israel, and essentially there are a lot of similarities, so it's Sharia compliant. And I actually trying to put the Islamic finance and EV, electric vehicle, it's hand in hand. It's very much the same. Like EV, before all the push from the government and Elon Musk and with Tesla and everything, it has been going on for some time, but the cost of adoption is very high, cost of technology is very high, until it reaches a certain inflection point and everybody's kind of pushing and becoming cheap. It's still very high, but it's good for the world, it's good for the environment and for people, right? Despite all of the limitations. I think Islamic finance is also the same. It's been going on for some time. It hasn't had enough push, I think, from governments as compared to EV. It hasn't had its Elon Musk or Tesla or whatever, that it's connect to young people and value push and movement and whatnot. But then I think principally it's the same. It's a higher cost of adoption just because we haven't reached that inflection point yet. But it's good for humanity. It can avoid crisis. It's fairer. It's more transparent and whatnot, right? So I think we're Islamic finance probably behind of EV, but we're hoping to see one day it becoming as mainstream as EV and people actually embracing it as a fairest form of financial system.
Okay. If you look at halal, right, in Malaysia, it's all about voluntarily basis. We don't force people to go and get certification. So I think this is where Islamic fintech and Islamic bank should be looking at. How do you create that value proposition so that people will start going or adopting or going into Sharia compliance and whatnot? So this is the challenge that we need to address. I think we need to find that, if I may, the holy grail of Islamic bank or Islamic solution, so that people would want to go there voluntarily. And I believe that if we should be leveraging on, the five things that I mentioned earlier, you know, the social finance, which is the zakat, wakaf, and all those. So because from our point of view, I think we are not fully utilizing or leveraging on whatever that Islam has to offer. I believe that if we can effectively use that and incorporate that as part of the financing mechanism, I think we can create some sort of a good value proposition.
Not specifically Islamic finance, but I'm talking about Islamic economy as a general, as a whole. You know, Muslim makes up about 25% of the world population. It's about 2.5 billion. It's about 2.5 billion. It's about almost 20%. In Southeast Asia alone, there's about 40% of the whole region. It's quite a big market. You should start from here. I think if you want to improve all these products, startups, Islamic banking, everything and all that, I think you should start from here in this region. You should be focused on innovation, technology, utilizing technology, talking about regulation as well. It has to, you know, really start from here. It's because, and only after that will be, I think, can we be accepted worldwide? The thing about Islamic, whatever it is, it's all about ethics, right? In proximity, you know, whether we really practice or not, but or the very core is about ethics, and it's acceptable anywhere in the world, right? So again, it has to start from here. That's what I'm trying to say here.
The topic of this panel is Blueprint for the Future and in an ecosystem for the successful development and distribution of Islamic financial services. I think my wish is for all of us to work together. I think when Bank Negara first announced the digital banking license, there's, you know, articles about us being competing with incumbent banks and etc. We're not, you know. There's no way where we can even compete to the established banks here. We're just addressing the crumbs of the things which, you know, the banks don't want to touch. But, you know, for me, my wish is we really need to work together. We're not competitors. You know, I know there are some bankers out there. In fact, we should be working very closely with other, not just banks, but Islamic fintechs, halal corporation, because our competitors is the scammers out there. You know, the scammers industry is going to surpass the Islamic financial services industry if we don't get ourselves act together. So for us, please don't treat, you know, between us in here as competitors. We should be working very closely out together and really protect our customers. So that's my ask. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Evan. Thank you for sharing your thoughts on stage today. And thank you for having us. We had a great audience. We didn't get an opportunity to go to you for questions. But having said that, the speakers will be around at any point in time. If you have any questions, please find us and we will be happy to address. I'm representing Temenos. We have a booth out there. Please do visit us. We are a large technology company providing support to Islamic financial institutes, and we are very happy to connect with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening. For more discussions on the Islamic finance industry, log on to www.islamicfinancenews.com. You can also listen to IFN Podcast on your favorite platforms, including iTunes and Spotify.